Gemara Megillah tells us that the schar tznius, the reward for tznius that Rachel had because she was a tznua, because she was modest, she was zocha to have Shaul come out from her lineage. And in the reward for the tznius, for the modesty that Shaul exhibited, he was zocha to have Esther come from his lineage. And then the Gemara explains these two events. What is the modesty, the tznius, that Rachel exhibited? The pasuk says, "Vayaged Yaakov l'Rachel." Yaakov said to Rachel that I am the brother of your father. It wasn't true. Yaakov wasn't the brother of his father. Explains the Gemara that Yaakov was saying something very specific to Rachel. They had met at the well and they had made up to marry, but Rachel said, "It's not going to work. My father is devious. He's deceitful." Says Yaakov, "What do you mean? What's he going to do?" Explains Rachel, "I have an older sister, and there's no way he's going to allow me to get married before my older sister. He, even if he says he will, he's going to pull some kind of trick. He's going to trick you out of it." At which point says Yaakov, "Achivani b'ramayis, I am his brother in trickery." "Is a tzaddik allowed to be involved in this?" Says Yaakov, "Yes." And at that point, Yaakov gave the simonim to Rachel. Those three simonim, nida, hadlakas aner, the three simonim of chala, nida, hadlakas aner, the three mitzvahs that are main mitzvahs of a woman, those were the secret code. The plan was that if in fact Lavan was going to try to put someone instead of Rachel, Yaakov would ask, "What's the password? What's the secret code?" That imposter obviously wouldn't know it. So there was no way that Yaakov could be fooled. They had a foolproof plan in place. And with that, Yaakov went to work for 7 years for Rachel. At the end of the 7 years, Yaakov says to Lavan, "Okay, it's time for me to take my bride." And in fact, Lavan prepared the wedding feast. And that night, Rachel realized what was happening. In fact, her father did exactly that which she had anticipated. Her father got Leah dressed up in the clothing of a bride. And in that moment, Rachel realized that her sister was going to be embarrassed. Her sister was going to come to the tzaddik, and the tzaddik was going to say, "What is the password?" Obviously, Leah would not know it. She'd be embarrassed. Says Rachel, "I cannot sit by and watch my sister's embarrassment." And she told the simonim, she told the password over to Leah. Explains Rashi, what was the tznius there? What was the modesty? The modesty was that this was a private agreement between husband and wife. See, the pasuk says, "Vahiba boke v'Leah." In the morning, it was Leah. Yaakov didn't realize until the morning that it was Leah, because in fact, this woman gave the password, and in fact, fooled him. But if Rachel would have let that be known, if she would have spread the word, told her father, or told others that there's a private password between husband and wife, it would have been a lack of tznius. It would have been proper. There are certain things that are very private, certain things that shouldn't get out. And therefore, even though in theory Rachel had a way of not telling Leah the password, she could have let the word spread that there's a secret password between us. So get the word back to my father. There's no way he's going to succeed in tricking Yaakov. She didn't do that because that would have been a violation of tznius. Private matters between husband and wife remain private, and therefore she felt she had no choice but to tell her sister. And because of this tremendous tznius, this tremendous sensitivity to private matters between husband and wife, she was zocha, she merited having Shaul HaMelech come from her. And then the Gemara explains to us what the modesty of Shaul was. The Navi came to appoint Shaul as king, but it wasn't clear at all to anyone who was to be king. In fact, all Shaul really did was go to the Navi to ask a certain question about lost items. And when he came back, he didn't mention to anyone what the Navi had said to him. And Shmuel had told him that, "Don't worry about the lost items. You are going to be a melech." But when his uncle asked him, "Shaul, what did you discuss with the Ish Elokim?" there was no mention of the fact that this man had just told him that he was to be the Melech Yisrael. Shaul didn't want to brag. He didn't want to let it be known. When it's time for it to be known, it'll be known. Until that point, there's no reason to mention it. And he exhibited tremendous modesty, not to mention to his very uncle that he is now going to be the king of Israel, is astonishing modesty. And because of the modesty that Shaul exhibited, he merited having Esther Hamalka come from him. So the modesty of Rachel begot Shaul, and the modesty of Shaul begot Esther. And this Gemara would be very powerful and very interesting if it weren't for the fact that there is a clear and obvious question on this Gemara. And that is that tznius is something that we're quite familiar with. And tznius is, there are certain issues that aren't to be public knowledge, certain behaviors between husband and wife, certain modes of dress that are inappropriate, there are certain things that are private that should remain private. But what in the world does that have to do with Shaul HaMelech being a humble individual? Tznius is a mode of dress. And tznius is an issue of keeping things that are supposed to be private, private. But what does that have to do with modesty, as in humility, which is a totally different midah? What does tznius have to do with that? And it sounds like the Gemara is comparing tznius, modesty, and dress, modesty in behavior, to something totally unrelated called humility, when Shaul wouldn't brag. And it sounds like the two have nothing one to do with the other. And while it sounds that way, I'd like to share with you that really it's quite different. And if you'd like to understand the answer to this question, I'll give you an interesting illustration. Imagine you have a woman. She went to a fine Beis Yaakov, and she knows all the halachas, and she knows exactly what tznius is. And she walks into a room, we'll call it maybe it's a wedding, and it's a sophisticated audience, so they also know the halacha. But she walks into this room dressed to kill, drop dead gorgeous, attention to every detail. And the wedding, to tell you the truth, sort of doesn't quite stop when she walks in, but everyone notices that her dress is maybe a little tighter than it really should be, and she is the fashion plate, unbelievable, and all eyes turn to her. Interestingly enough, we call her a tsanua. She's a tsnius woman, right? Listen, her sleeves are longer than required. Her dress hem is longer than required. She meets all the requirements for tsnius. Yet she couldn't possibly be further from being a tsanua, because the word tsanua means modest. Tsnius is a manifestation of a midah called humility, called, I don't want to be the center of attention. I don't want to attract other people looking at me. I'm uncomfortable with the limelight. I'm uncomfortable being in the center of everyone's vision. Tznius comes from the word tsanua. Tsanua means modesty. Would you like to understand why Shaul HaMelech exhibited the same midah as did Rachel? Because tznius comes from humility. It comes from humbleness. It manifests itself in different ways. It manifests itself in not bragging, and it manifests itself in mode of dress and conduct. But if a woman dresses very, very fine according to all regulation, but she's very loud and very showy, she's not a tsanua, she's not a modest woman, quite the opposite. And I'd like to share with you, when that woman walks into that room and all eyes turn to her, what she doesn't realize is that she's doing some damage to her inner sense of balance. You see, the nature of a woman is to be a tsanua, to be modest. And when a woman calls attention to herself, there are two diverse feelings that are deep within her heart. On the one hand, whoa, this is great. Look at his attention. Everyone's looking at me and I look gorgeous and my dress and my shade. Wow, I love the attention. And there's another part of her that's screaming out in agony, ouch, everybody's looking at me, everyone's paying attention to me, I'm in the center of everyone's eye. Ew. A woman by nature is a tsanua, is modest, and when she's showy, and when she's noticed, and she's out there, she's going against her inner nature. And if you'd like to see miserable people, you find miserable people in many different walks of life. And when you watch a person who's literally in contradiction, who's literally in contradiction against her very nature, watch a woman who's showy and who's loud and who dresses according to all regulation, but the whole purpose of the dress and the mode is one thing: attract as much attention as I can. And when she walks in that room, within her there's an inner tension, there's a tremendous disharmony, because part of her is screaming out, ouch, part of her is saying, wow, this is great, I love the attention, and part of her is in utter conflict. But the point is that tznius is not about length of sleeves and not about necklines. Tznius is about not wishing to call attention to myself, not wishing to have all the glamour and the attraction, and it's a mode of conduct. It manifests itself in dress, certainly in certain obvious ways and certain not so obvious ways, but it's a very, very pure mida of humility. It manifests itself in a woman by dressing appropriately. In a man, it manifests itself more in not bragging. But the mida itself is modesty. The mida itself is humility. It's interesting to note that women are known as tsanua. By nature, women are far more humble than our men. The reason why tznius is stressed to a woman is not just because she shouldn't attract men's attention, not just because it's destructive in many levels, but because it goes against her very essence. A woman is modest far more than is a man. A woman is a different nature, a different way. You could see it when children are little. The male ego, that bombastic, covet-seeking, power-seeking, dominating force, exists much more blatantly and much more prominently in the male than it does in the female. And I'd like to share with you that this concept is fundamental to understanding Shalom Bayis and understanding how a husband and wife have to get along. Let's review. The Rambam gave us a formula for Shalom Bayis that is foolproof, that is guaranteed. Our Chachamim obligated the man to honor his wife more than himself and love her as himself. And Chazal obligated the woman to treat her husband with honor exceedingly. But do you notice that there's a very real difference? A very real difference in what Chazal obligated the man to his wife and what Chazal obligated the wife to the husband. Chazal obligated a man to treat his wife with more honor than himself and love her like himself. And Chazal obligated a woman to treat her husband with excess honor, to treat him almost with a yira, almost with an awe, as if he's a king or a prince. Why is it that there's a difference in the obligations that Chazal put on the man and the woman? And the reason is because each, the husband and the wife, have different needs in the relationship. And if you would like to know how to treat a wife, and if you'd like your wife to be happy, there's one thing. If a woman knows that she's cherished, if she knows that she's treasured, that she's precious, that she comes first, she will be happy. That's what a woman needs. The Stipler in his Igeres writes something that's so powerful. He writes that the main hope of a woman in her world is to have a husband who loves her. When she sees that it isn't so, it crushes a spirit and can be close to pikuach nefesh. What a husband has to show his wife is that she is number one, that she's cherished, that she's treasured, that she's prized above anyone else. And when a husband shows that to his wife feels happy. She feels satisfied. Her emotional needs in the marriage are met. And if she doesn't feel that, well, guess what? She's going to be very unhappy, very displeased, and feel very empty. This marriage isn't doing for me. And understanding that's a woman's needs in the marriage and understanding how to meet those needs requires a tremendous amount of understanding. But let's focus on the other side of this. Chazal say that a woman is obligated to treat her husband with exceeding honor. Treat him as if he's a prince, as if he's a king, to obey his every wish, his every word. Why would Chazal put an extra obligation on the woman to treat her husband that way. Would you like to know the reason for that? The reason for that is quite simple. What a man needs in the marriage is a bit different. The woman needs to feel cherished, but the man needs something subtly different. The man needs to feel respected. He needs to feel that his wife admires him, honors him, respects him. That's the emotional need of a man. A man has a different ego need than does a woman. Male ego is something that's very, very delicate, very, very prominent. And if a woman doesn't learn to work with her husband's ego, she's going to have a lot of difficulty in the marriage. And if a woman says, hey, he's a baby, male ego, I have to bend, go through hoops of fire because he has an ego problem, saying those words are a disaster in the formation. Thinking those words are very foolish. A husband has to understand the nature of his wife, and the wife has to understand the nature of her husband. And if each of them have this attitude of whatever, I can just trample on it because he's a baby or she's a crybaby or whatever it may be, there will be an awful lot of trouble. And I've seen this time after time after time. Two reasonable people who are socially appropriate in every other situation, people look at and say, he's a mensch, she's a mensch, and they're fighting cats and dogs. And oftentimes at the seba, at the root of it, is that they don't understand each other's needs and they constantly trample on those needs. In science, there's a famous saying. The most critical words in science, the words that preempted almost every scientific discovery, is not, Eureka, I've discovered it. The words that begin almost every discovery in science are the words, that's strange. You see, almost every discovery in science began the scientists crawling into a small area, studying some phenomena, and then something didn't make sense. Wait a minute, that doesn't fit. Why is that? That's strange. And because he understood the system and understood the parts of the system, this doesn't fit. Well, why not? And he began digging and digging, and that's what brings about the great scientific discoveries. It's not the word, Eureka, I've discovered it. It's the words, that's strange. And then going digging in to understand why it is that that phenomenon is happening. And the reason why I share that with you is because I believe that there are two words in a marriage that are vital. Two words in a marriage that are vital to the success of any marriage. And it's not what you think. It's not, I love you. Not even, by the way, it's three words. But not even, I'm sorry. Nope. The two words that are critical to the success of a marriage are the words, that's strange. As in, that's strange. Why did he react that way? We were talking about whatever, and it sounded innocent enough. And then he got all upset, and that's strange. That's strange. Why is she crying? We were just talking about going somewhere for Shabbos. We had this plan, that plan, and all of a sudden she's crying. That's strange. And do you know why those two words are vital for the success of a marriage? Because when you ask those words, what you then say to yourself is, okay, let me understand my spouse. The way she behaved right now doesn't fit the pattern that I understand. It doesn't fit the way I would react, but I know she's a sane, rational, grounded person. Why did she react that way? My husband is always patient, tolerant, and kind. And why all of a sudden did he change? And if you train yourself to say the words, that's strange, and then dig in, what you'll begin discovering is the emotional underpinning of your spouse, the emotional needs, and you'll be able to be a good spouse. But if you don't do this process, you're going to have a lot of trouble in your marriage because unwittingly, husbands destroy their wives, and unwittingly, wives destroy their husbands. They don't see it coming. They don't realize what they're doing. They think they're acting fine and regular, and all of a sudden, For some strange reason, the marriage starts unraveling and disintegrating. And if you don't become a student of your spouse's emotional needs, you're going to cause a lot of trouble unintentionally, and it's going to come back to haunt you. And I'd like to share with you one manifestation of this. But to understand this manifestation, let's go to a schoolyard. Let's watch boys at play and girls at play, and we'll begin to note the differences between them. If you ever watch little children at play, you'll see that boys and girls, even at a tender young age, first grade, second grade, play very different sort of games. Boys play these independent games. Girls usually play as a group, sometimes as twos, sometimes as three, but the groups are always very central to what they're doing. Girls are always part of this sort of social connection. As a matter of fact, when girls play together, it really doesn't matter who wins and who loses. Usually the biggest focus is on there shouldn't be hostility and everyone should get a turn and everyone should have a good time. But boys don't play that way. Boys play with a tremendous emphasis on competition, and boys play with a real burning edge, and it doesn't matter what he feels like. It matters whether I win, I get on base, how I do. And if you'd like to see one of the manifestations of this, watch what happens when a child gets hurt. If boys are playing a game, whether it be baseball or basketball, whatever it may be, and one of the boys fall down and is crying, the expectation is that he'll get out of the way and let the game go on. What are you, crybaby? Get out of here. We got a game to play. And the expectation is that the hurt fellow will just find himself a place on the side to recuperate because the game will go on. But when girls are playing a game and one of the girls get hurt, the entire game stops. Oh, are you okay? Are you okay? And if you begin studying the games that they play and the way that they play games, you begin to understand that there's a vast difference in the emotionality of boys and of girls. Number one, we've discussed already, the fact that girls need, crave, and seek social connection. Usually, girls play to be a part of the team. Boys typically don't have anywhere near that social need. They play, they'll join a team to compete, but it's about the competition, it's about the game, it's not about the social group. But it really cuts much deeper. It's the relationships themselves that are unique. You see, girls' relationships are almost all symmetrical, almost all on the same level. We're one unit, we're one group, we're all together. In boys' relationships, it's almost all hierarchical. There's always a team leader, and there's always someone on top, and there's someone under. And as a matter of fact, if you watch boys play, the attempt of each boy is to dominate, to be on top, to assert his individual status. And even when they play games as a team, it's who's the best shortstop, who's the best, who has the best outside shot. Boys play games with winners and losers. A boy's success in a competitive game will usually determine his status. If he's a very good ball player, he's looked up to. If he's a mediocre ball player, whatever. And it's not that uncommon for a boy with a higher status not just to get covered, but for it to be expected that he's going to be more popular, have different rights, he's a different sort of person. And if you focus on it, what you realize is that boys play to dominate, girls play to connect, and it's because the relationships are very, very different. Almost every relationship that a woman has with another woman is a peer relationship. They're equals, they're on the same team. Most of the relationships that boys have with other boys is based on someone is in charge. You ever notice that boys are very comfortable wearing uniforms? Little boys love to dress up. A policeman, and a policeman tells people what to do. A fireman has his status. Guys wear clothing as a display of power, of prestige. Women typically wear clothing as a way of expressing herself. And the difference in the relationships shows itself in many, many situations. And you have to really think in these terms to recognize how significant and how much it manifests itself in a marriage. If a guy spent his whole life either being a teacher or a student, team leader or player, master, so to speak, or one under that level, and a girl spent her whole life with symmetrical relations, all the same. You ever notice girls are very uncomfortable if a young aunt or even an older aunt, don't call me by aunt, call me by my first name. They're uncomfortable with titles. They're uncomfortable with head nurse even. Call me team leader. I don't like the position that I should be above. Girls are much more comfortable in a peer-to-peer symmetrical relation, and guys have been accustomed their whole life to a hierarchy. And let me share with you where this manifests itself and how it shows itself in a marriage. When I wrote the first Shmooze on the Parsha book, I asked my mother-in-law to copy edit it. My mother-in-law has a very, very fine eye, and she catches very, very fine mistakes. And I thought she would do a very good job. She was quite busy at the time. She was still working. But she volunteered, and she did it, and she did an excellent job. When I was writing the acknowledgments, I was tempted to write a certain line. What I wanted to write in the acknowledgments was, I'd like to thank my mother-in-law for copy editing this book, but there's nothing that gives a mother-in-law more nachas than correcting her son-in-law, so I don't have to thank her. Now, I didn't write the line because I didn't think it was really respectful. It turns out that later on, my wife told my mother-in-law that I was tempted to write it. My mother-in-law laughed and said, you should have written it. But here's a certain reality. You ever notice that mother-in-laws get a bad reputation? Would you like to know a big part of the reason? You see, the nature of a woman is to be nurturing. The nature of a woman is to be caring and giving. And a young woman brings home the chassan, and the future mother-in-law looks and says, wow, great guy. This Mila and that Mila, he's great. But like anybody, sure, he could use, improve, he could be even better. And she does her best to help him. And of a kindly, giving, nurturing nature, she wishes to make him even better. He's a great guy, but I can make him even better. And she tries to do just that, to nurture, to care, to improve him. And what she finds is a lot less than a welcome reception. And you know why? Because amongst guys, unsolicited advice is considered rude. Amongst guys, if I walk over to another fellow and tell him, hey, you should do it this way instead of that way, it's considered bossy and showy and obnoxious. It's not considered that way amongst women. Why? Because women are all peers. And when a woman goes over to another woman and says, you know, you could do it, you're good, but you could do it even better, what she's showing is that she cares. She's expressing love. The one who's receiving that unsolicited advice receives it in that way, and it's a wonderful thing to do. But guys don't operate that way. And if a guy would go over to another guy and say, you know, you should do it this way because it's better, more efficient, the receiver would consider it an insult. Mach, are you telling me what to do? What are you, above me? What are you, some... And unbeknownst to many mother-in-laws, they offer unsolicited advice, and they find themselves unpopular very quickly. Now, this is not about having mother-in-laws be more popular or less popular. This is about a way, way bigger issue. Most kallahs, when they come to the chuppah, they have an agenda. Let's call it a 10-point program. This guy is great. He's wonderful. He's a star. Gold. But listen, you know, there are things that I intend to improve. He's going to, you know, I'm going to change the way he dresses and, you know, being on time thing and, you know, the way he eats with a knife and fork. A 10-point program of home improvement, how she's going to make him. He's great now, but she's going to make him even better. And why does she want to do this? Because she loves him. She's concerned for him and she wants to nurture him. And they get married in the Sheva Brachas, and when the Sheva Brachas are done, she begins her agenda, her 10-point program. And she starts helping her husband change this area. She helps fix her husband in this area. And she doesn't quite understand what's going on. I don't understand this. I showed him how much I love him by trying to help him. He's got a neatness issue, right? He knows it. I know it. So I'm trying to help him. I come into his office and I said to him, how could you even concentrate in here? The place is a mess. You should clean up. Now, everyone understands that I only said that because I want his best. I love him. But strangely enough, he didn't respond that way. I don't get it. He didn't thank me. Not only didn't he thank me for my love, he got cold and distant. I don't understand what's with him. I don't get it. Something strange going on. But of course, she is a loving, nurturing person, so she continues on her 10-point program, and she makes it a point to help him and improve him, help him and improve him, and for some reason, she can't quite figure out why he keeps getting distant and cold and then starts being short-tempered. I don't know what happened to this guy. I married a nice guy, and certainly till the chuppah, he was a great guy, and all of a sudden he changes, and all of a sudden he's getting really short-tempered, and he's getting nasty, and he's saying things that are that are uncalled for, and there's no reason, and there's absolutely nothing I'm doing other than showing how much I care for him, and I love him, and he gets all, I don't know what's with him. I don't get it. There's something wrong with the guy. There's something wrong. And she is correct. There is something wrong. What's wrong is the way she's handling him. And if she continues on that path, she's going to have a lot of trouble. Because guys by nature don't take well to advice, to unsolicited advice, to better ways of doing things. And you should say, well, but come on, he should just be a mensch. Don't have such a big male ego, guy. It's a very nice thing to say. And if you'd like to wreck your marriage, try it. Try it. Rely on the fact that he's as humble as Rabbi Kager. Rely on the fact that he's like Moshe Rabbeinu. And just rely on the fact that he'll be sovel your barbs and your arrows that you shoot at him. What do you mean barbs and arrows? I'm doing it for his good. I'm trying to help him. I'm trying to make him even a better mensch. What do you mean barbs and arrows? And if you were a woman talking to another woman, it would be lovely words, nice things that she would receive that way. But what you're doing to your husband is you're shooting arrows directly at him. And for the life of him, he doesn't understand why is she starting up. What is her problem? Why can't she just be happy? What is she constantly criticizing, critiquing, and bothering? What is her problem? I don't get her. What's her problem? Why can't she just be normal? Just live your life. I don't tell you what to do. I don't sit there telling you all the time. And you're telling me, why can't you just be a mensch? And she doesn't understand him. And he doesn't understand her. And guess what? There are lots of things that are said. Lots of water that passes under the bridge. And before you know it, he says and she says and he says and she says. And before you know it, it's getting pretty, pretty heated and pretty nasty. If a woman wants to be happily married, you have to understand the nature of your spouse. What a man needs at the core of his essence is to feel competent, to feel respected. And when someone comes over to him and says, don't do it that way, do it this way, the message that he hears is, you are not competent. You are not respected. But I only said it because I love him. You could say it for any reason that you want. The message that he heard way louder than your words was the message that you don't respect him. Because guys who respect guys don't do that. I know a Rav, a Chashav Posek, who told me that in his own house, to his own children, he never offers unsolicited advice. If they ask me, I'll tell them. But if not, he won't offer. This man gets calls from Arba Kanfos, every part of the world. People call him all day long with questions for his advice, but at his own table, he will not offer unsolicited advice because people don't take kindly to it. And if women do, it's because that's the nature of their relationships, their peers, one to another. They understand that it's set out of love, out of nurturing, out of care, and it's received that way. But certainly men don't talk to men that way. And when a man hears those words, he does not feel loved, he doesn't feel nurtured, he feels bothered, he feels shepherd, why is she doing this? Doesn't she understand? I drive 15,000 miles a year. I've been driving for 30 years. I've logged 500,000 miles. And she has to tell me how to drive?
She has to tell me how to drive. Put on your blinker. Shut off your blinker. Turn left. Turn right. Oh, stop. Slow down. Do you know what he hears? What he hears loud and clear is, I don't respect you. You're not competent. You need my help. You're not like a person who can actually drive yourself. For 500,000 miles he's driven himself, lady. With all due respect, he spent quite a number of hours behind the wheel and got there without you. And what you're telling him louder than anything is, I don't respect you. I didn't mean that. I just saying it. And this is one of the things that women have to learn about men. Men have a lot to learn about women. But one of the things that women have to learn about men, if they wish to be successfully married, is that the male ego doesn't respond well to what he perceives as chepering, as criticism, as critiques, as even attempts to improve. And if you'll say, oh, but he's just a baby, he should grow up, you might be right, but you're not going to be happily married. And if you'd like to be happily married, you have to understand that the male ego functions differently than the woman's. When he's 50, when he's 60, when he's 80, will he still be this way? Most likely. Even as an Adam Gadol, even as a great man who's very humble, the male ego is fashioned differently, and he'll still perceive when someone tells him what to do that it's exactly that. Someone is standing above me. Someone is going into the upper position, looking down upon me, bossing me. Well, my girlfriend never perceives it that. You're right. Women do it all the time to women, and it's okay. But if you climb into a man's world and you put on your home improvement committee cap and you decide that you're going to fix your husband, and even if it's out of goodness and concern, you're going to suffer an awful lot of trouble. And if I could give one word of advice to a chassan and to a kala, my word of advice to the kala would be, don't fix your husband. Accept him. Would you like him to grow? That's great. Would you like him to improve? That's wonderful. But don't you be the one to tell him, and don't show him, because what's going to happen is it will backfire. The exact opposite is what's going to happen. It's not going to succeed in making him better in that area. All it's going to do is make him angry, make him upset, and cause a lot of shalom bias problems. And if you'd like to grow, there are many ways to grow, many ways to grow together, but don't be the fix-it woman. Don't improve your husband. Don't have an agenda. And excuse me for saying it this way, but friends accept friends for who they are. Friends accept friends for where they're holding. They don't fix them. They don't have agendas. Because if you have an agenda and you're trying to fix your husband, what he's going to hear is that you don't respect him. And at the core of your relationship, you're potentially endangering things. But there's another difference between the male ego and the female ego that surfaces in a marriage in a very real way. Men are very comfortable living alone. Women like to say that men live in their cave. They're alone, and that's fine. Men typically, you know, they'll have buddies, they'll have friends. But in a guy's world, friends means people, you slap on the back, hey, how you doing? Good, you're good, okay. And they go their separate ways. And even if they're chavrusas, and they learn hours and hours a day. I've had chavrusas who were masmidim, who I barely spoke a word outside of learning to. And I could tell you that we were yedidim, we were friends, and I would go to the guy's simchas. But the need to share, to express, connect, it's not as typical and certainly not as much in a man's world. Men are much more comfortable living in caves. Women live in communities. And the way that manifests itself is in a very interesting way in a marriage. Chassan and Kala get married, happily married after a few weeks, and he decides, Motzei Shabbos, he wants to go play ball. So he, you know, after Abdullah, he says, you know what, dear, I'm going to go play ball, and he goes out to play basketball, and he comes back later than he thought he would, comes back 2 in the morning, and she's sitting there crying. Why didn't you call? Why couldn't you at least call? And she feels,
that he mamish rejected her. You just leave. You walk out. You don't even really tell me where you're going. And when you're late, you don't even call. And you know what he feels? What he feels is that she's trying to control him. What do I have? My every move, I have to tell you where I went. Every single place I go, I have to let you know. And I can't go somewhere without letting you know. And I can't. She feels rejected, that he doesn't want a relationship. And he feels that she's controlling him. Now, let me go on record. As a husband, it is your duty to make sure that your wife knows where you are. Make sure that she knows when you're coming late and you call and you act as a mensch, because it is torturous to a wife, especially to a young wife, to have a husband just walk out and not be there. But it's more important to understand why it's torturous to her. It's torturous to her because she wants a connection. She wants to feel bonded. She wants to feel one with you. And when you just walk out and you don't even tell her where you're going, and you don't even tell her you're coming back or not coming back, what she hears in very real terms is the fact that your relationship isn't. You're not really bonded. You're not connected. You know what the Chazanish says? The Chazanish says that the first year, a husband has to be very careful to speak to his wife. But not just speak to his wife. He says, Lohodia b'yetziel anhu holech, to tell her when you're leaving where you're going, and when you come back where you were. Small things. Why? Because that's what she needs. She wants to feel connected. She wants to feel part of your life. She wants to feel a part of you. And if you walk out and you don't tell her where you're going, and if you stay away late and don't let her know, what she hears very clearly is that the relationship isn't. That you're breaking the bond, you're running away, you're trying to escape. And again, it's a husband's obligation to tell his wife and make sure that he shares with her, but it's also a wife's obligation to understand why he has this need for independence. You see, when a guy is controlled, when he has to report, he feels like he's in jail. What I have to tell you, everywhere I go, here and there, and you know why he feels that way? He feels that way because that's the way guys are. They're not comfortable with being connected. They're not used to it. Maybe his mother bothered him, tell me if you're going to be out late. But that's my mother. Come on. I'm grown up now. I don't need someone to make sure that I actually, maybe you tell me how to tie my shoes now, and you tell me don't stay out too late because it's dangerous. And he feels controlled. And this is a delicate balance. He has to be a mensch. He has to be sensitive. He has to recognize that he has to share with his wife where he goes when he stays late, because it's part of building the connection. And she has to understand his need for independence. And many times it surfaces in a very interesting way. Suddenly, the husband says to his wife, young wife, 6 months, you know, I invited two of my buddies over for Shabbos. I hope you make a good Shabbos. And she says to herself, oh my goodness, how could he do that to me? He just invites them over without asking me, without even consulting me. And I'd like to share with you often why he does that and what is really going on. His buddies called him up and said, hey, you know, we're in town for Shabbos. Can we come over? Now, the menschlich thing to do, obviously, is for him to say, listen, I'd love to have you guys. Let me check with my wife. But in guys' talk, you know what that says? I'm not really in charge. I got this master. I'm not an independent person. I'm tied to this other person. I'm like a slave. So I hope you'll excuse me, guys. I gotta get permission from the boss, okay? And for a young guy, it's very uncomfortable. Now again, he has to do that because it's highly rude to spring something like that on your wife and say, here are two guests and tough luck, you prepare for them. So he has to ask. But a woman has to also understand why it's difficult for him often to ask. Because until he grows a little bit more, until he becomes a little bit more mature, he's uncomfortable with the sense of attachment. You see, a woman naturally feels attached to others and prides herself on those attachments. The more friends, the more involved I am in other people's lives, the more a woman feels good about herself. So for her to say to another woman, let me check with my husband, She's almost bragging. You so we're so attached. We're so one that I can't do it. I can't approve this on my own. I need my husband's approval. That's a sense of pride that we have a real relationship. And the reason for that is because that's a woman's relationship. Women take pride in their relationships. Women enjoy that. And it's easy for her. But what a husband has to learn is to be comfortable with that relationship. And he has to learn that it's not a source of dishonor that he's got to check with his wife. But initially, it's going to feel that way. Initially, it's going to feel that she's clipping my wings. And I have to answer to somebody. I can't just make plans. And he's going to be embarrassed in front of his buddies. And a wise woman will be tolerant and understanding. Again, it's his job to make sure that he grows up, that he asks permission and does what he's supposed to. But it's a wise woman who also understands where he's coming from. And the reason why I think this issue is so vital is because so many times couples stab each other without even recognizing the why. The why they stab each other is because men and women are different. And as many times as we can say it, it never hits you until you finally say, oh my goodness, that's why he's behaving that way. Oh my, that's why she's carrying on. Oh, I finally got it. What Chazal are sharing with us is that tznius is a midah of humility. And Shaul exhibited humility. And the ultimate expression of tznius is what Leah did. There are things that are so private, so no one should know about. I am a tsunua that I can't speak about them. But tznius in dress, tznius in conduct, tznius in attitude all stems from the same humility. A woman is a tsunua. A woman is far more humble than is a man. Does it mean that every woman is a tsunua? It certainly doesn't. First of all, there are plenty of women who dress quite the opposite. And more than that, you have women who brag and who show off. But the nature of a woman is to be more of a tsunua, to be more humble, to be more modest. And one of the ways that it manifests itself is in the very relationships that they have. And because they have this modesty, because they have this natural humility, they're very comfortable with relationships. They're very comfortable with peer-to-peer relationships. They're very comfortable with a web of connections. And they're all peers. They're all the same. But the male ego doesn't function that way. The male ego is always someone's the teacher and someone else is the student. Someone's the leader and someone else is the follower. Men are competitive, some far more than others, but the male ego is such that it doesn't take well to someone standing on top of him, pointing a finger and saying, this is how it shall be done now because I'm the boss. And whether a woman realizes that or not, when she helps her husband do things better, what he hears in very loud words are, you're not competent, you're not good enough, you need my help. And he doesn't perceive it as a peer-to-peer, as a symmetrical relationship, as two equals. He hears it, there she goes again, trying to boss me around. There she goes again, trying to make trouble. What is a problem? Why can't you just be happy? And it is a wise woman who trains herself not to correct her husband, not to fix him, not to improve. But I love him. Well, if you love him, you'll understand him and you won't try to destroy your relationship. Because all you have to do is do it often enough, and even the most easygoing, tolerant guy is going to feel so much pain and so much, why is she doing this? Why is she doing, why can't she? And he's going to let out, whether it be in anger, whether it be in a snide remark, whether it be in something other than what you'd expect, you're not going to get loving, caring words back. You're going to get a lot of suffering back. And it is a wise woman who becomes aware the most important words in a marriage are, that's strange. Yes, it's important to say, I love you, and thousands and thousands of times. Yes, it's important to say, I'm sorry, thousands and thousands of times. But as much as you say those expressions, it's vital to say the words, that's strange. When you see your wife do something that doesn't make sense, not a guy I know in the world would do that, that's when it's time to stop and say, okay, why? Why is she doing that? Why is she reacting that way? And when you do that, you begin studying, you begin understanding, you begin relating to the emotional world of your wife. And a wife has to do the same to a husband. She has to understand him. And when he does things that don't make sense to her, and she gets dismissive, oh, he's a creep and he's a bum, or he's just a guy, or well, he's just in a bad mood. You can get away with it sometimes, to some extent, but do it often enough, and you're going to suffer. Your relationship is going to pay the price. And what a woman has to do when she sees a reaction that doesn't make sense, he's a normal, tolerant, normally he's a tolerant, easygoing guy. And for some reason, when I do this, he always seems to have a short fuse. Ask the question, why? Well, he says, because he's a baby. He's just got a male ego problem. And again, you can say the words, but you're going to pay the price. And I believe that this concept of understanding one another, and not just being tolerant of one another, but learning one another and understanding how to meet each other's needs. A husband has to study his wife and give her what she needs. She has to understand that she's cherished. And Mirza Shem in future sessions will describe some of the issues that guys do that destroy that sense of a woman being cherished. But that's what he has to give to his wife. And what a woman has to give to her husband is that sense of respect. And she has to know him well enough to know what that means. And even if in her world it's not disrespectful, if in his world it is, if he perceives it as disrespect, that's how he feels. And what you're doing is you're messing with something that's very, very dangerous. And what I'd like to close with is one of the most interesting stories I've ever read. Rav Shlomo Eger, the son of Rabbi Akiva Eger, writes in his Shals and Tshuvas that his father was offered a shidduch after the death of his mother. Rabbi Akiva Eger had been married, and he had children, and he even brought with his first wife these children to the chuppah, and his wife passed away. And he was then offered a shidduch. Now, obviously, this was long enough after the patira of his wife that people were already offering him a shidduch. And he writes back, Rav Shlomo Eger writes these words in the Igeres, he writes back that how could I even think about a shidduch? How could I even think about another woman? When she left me, I was bereft. This was a woman I sought counsel with. This was the person I shared my life with. When she left, there's nothing left. I can't eat. I can't drink. My stomach can't hold down food. I can't even make a bracha achrona. I can barely daven without breaking down. I could barely learn. How could you ask me to forget her? How could you ask me to marry someone else? And those words are a description of what a real marriage is about. A bonding, a connection, a love. But it's a love based on real feelings, real connections. And it's a husband who so misses his wife and feels so empty that he almost feels he can't go on. And this is a man of stature. Rabbi Akiva Eger was one of the Gedolei Achronim, one of the greatest people of his generation. All eyes of the Klal Yisrael turned to him. And he wasn't some kind of weak wimp. He was a very humble man, a very loving individual who had a beautiful marriage. And the Torah prescribes for us the formula. But you have to be wise and you have to use the system. May Hashem grant us the wisdom and the ability to put it into practice.